Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel talk show on myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor at Cure Talk, Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. Before we get into today's show, I would like to inform all those listening that our live on-air myeloma support group headed by Pat Killingsworth is meeting on 29th October at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And we are having Dr. Craig Hoffmeister and Gary Peterson as guests on the show discussing myeloma survival rates, life expectancy, and making survival data accessible to all. There is also a very interesting show coming up on 7th November at 6 p.m. in our yoga series, where this time we have three myeloma survivors share their stories on how yoga helped them through their treatments. All details are available on CureTalk, and you can access this at www.trilex.com/CureTalk. Coming back to today's show, this is the 33rd episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show. Our previous episode on myeloma had Dr. Ajay Chari of Mount Sinai Hospital discuss clinical trials and myeloma. Today, we have a very distinguished myeloma expert joining us. My co-host for the evening is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. Supporting Gary on the panel are myeloma survivors and advocates Pat Killingsworth, Jack Aiello, and Nick Van Dyke. Today, we are discussing whether to transplant or not. Currently, autologous stem cell transplant is a standard of care in myeloma because of its high response rate and relatively low morbidity and mortality. However, it is neither curative nor applicable to all patients. Growing understanding of our cellular mechanisms, proteins, and key signal transduction factors has led to a tremendous opportunity in the context of new drug development and multiple myeloma. With new drugs continuing to improve response rates in patients, role of stem cell transplant is set to change. And to learn how, stay tuned. Towards the end of the show, we will be addressing questions sent in by our listeners. With that, I will now hand over to Gary, who will introduce us to our expert for the show. Gary, you're live.
Well, thank you, Priya. And first, I'd like to thank you, Priya Menon of CureTalk, for your tireless efforts in providing this forum for the multiple myeloma patient community. Thank you, Priya, and as always, together we will save life. Our panel, Pat, Jack, and Nick, are all myeloma survivors, and we are very excited about our new guest. All of us on the panel have one thing in common, and that is that we all have been treated by some of the very, very best multiple myeloma specialists in the world. Our guest today is one of these exceptional myeloma specialists, and his name is Dr. Paul Richardson. And I only have a couple minutes to go through his extensive bio, so unfortunately, Doctor, this is going to be the Cliff Notes version. Because I went through it once, and I went way over my time limit. But I believe that most of your peers would also agree that you're one of the best, and that Dana-Farber and your myeloma program is one of the best in the world, and in my opinion is considered one of the fabulous five. Dr. Richardson is an associate professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. He's the clinical director at the Jeremy Lipper Center for Multiple Myeloma at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and a lecturer for both nationally and internationally. He is currently leading multiple efforts studying combination therapies in relapsed and refractory myeloma. Additionally, he holds leadership positions in several professional bodies, and I won't get into them all, but there are many. One of which is the MMRC, and he was the director there for, or the chairman of the clinical trials corps there. And in 2009, Dana-Farber was given the MMRC Center of the Year Award. So he's had some tremendous honors, and in addition to that, he's a publisher of 200 articles. Now, Doctor, we're honored and want to thank you so much for participating. I know that you're a very, very busy man, and we on the panel have been excited about this topic, to transplant or not to transplant, and are thankful that you have have been able to design clinical trials intended to answer this question. So welcome, Doctor. Doctor, are you there? Dr. Richardson?
Yes, Dr. Richardson, you're live?
I'm live. I'm on. Hello?
Okay. Yes, Doctor.
No, I'm sorry. I apologize for that. I've been on for quite a while, and thank you for your very kind comments, Gary. Deeply appreciate it. It's really my privilege and honor to be with you. Just one thing that I just wanted to acknowledge, because it's just so kind of you to say it, to say that, you know, we at Dana-Farber, it's our privilege to care for our patients and advance the field as best as we can, and I so deeply appreciate your kind comments. One thing I did want to say, and I think you may unfortunately have got a bio that was a little out of date, but obviously not to worry at all about that, but one of the nicest things is that as of certainly December of last year, I became a full professor at Harvard Medical School, but the reason I mention it is purely this, because the chair was actually endowed in the name of one of my patients who is very dear to me, R.J. Corman, Rick Corman, and so I'm actually the R.J. Corman Professor of Medicine. Why that's particularly first time that we have had a myeloma patient endow a chair at Harvard Medical School. So it's particularly poignant to be with you today with that in mind, and with the construct of being here for you tonight, and just to also especially acknowledge Rick in that context.
Well, that sounds fantastic, and I'm sorry about that.
Don't be sorry at all. It's just in the context of the of a patient seminar or discussion like this, I just want to especially acknowledge how our patients mean everything to us, and Rick is one example.
Okay, and Doctor, if sometime I apologize, I have a abscess tooth today.
Oh, no.
So I may be not as coherent as I might have been, but if we could, I know you've done a number of clinical trials already. You've got one planned. And my first question is stem cell transplants. You know, it's really what we're here to talk about today. Should we or shouldn't we? Is there a simple answer in your mind?
Well, Gary, I think that the reply I would have that's simple is that one size does not fit all. And I think that is the key message for patients on the line, is that as we think about where transplant belongs in the treatment of patients with myeloma who are, you know, tend to be younger and well enough to be able to withstand the potential intensity of the procedure and its attendant side effects, I think we need to realize that, as you so nicely framed it, Gary, the procedure has great merit. It can improve outcome in the majority of younger patients in whom it's used, but the reality is that it doesn't benefit everyone, and that there are a number of patients in whom clearly benefit isn't seen, and in also we're now in a position, thank goodness, with the new drugs that we have, to be able to generate responses that are of the quality and depth that are so impressive that we can actually achieve what we used to be only able to achieve with transplant alone. So a key question going forward is who benefits from it, and most importantly, when should it be used, early or late, and or later, as it were. And I think what I certainly struck by, and I think data now from various trials support it, is that clearly in younger patients, transplant provides benefit in the majority in terms of progression-free survival. However, overall survival doesn't appear to be meaningfully different to date, whether you have a transplant early, late, or not at all. But very, very importantly, With the advent of new drugs, we're recognizing that understanding where transplant belongs and in whom it best serves is a key question. So right now, we have clinical trials that are ongoing to address this very, very point. And these clinical trials are fundamental to helping us best understand how we can use transplant with novel therapies in the future.
Now, when you you pretty much answered, I guess, the second question, which was how does it fit into myeloma currently. But when you talk about the clinical trial that you have designed, could you get into more details about that and how that might answer this question?
Absolutely, Gary, and thank you for asking. Basically, what we've come to find is that when you use a combination of an immunomodulator, a proteasome inhibitor, and a steroid, and in this case that would be lenalidomide combined with bortezomib and dexamethasone, so-called RVD, the response rates are remarkably high. In fact, in our phase 1-2 trial that we originally performed some years ago now and published in Blood back in 2010, we were able to demonstrate in a multi-center study involving almost 70 patients that the response rate was 100% or better, with about 50% of the patients achieving complete remission over time. Now, that was very encouraging to us. This trial was not designed to specifically look at the transplant population, but to look at all comers. But when we looked at patients who were transplant eligible and went on to transplant versus those who did not, we saw no difference in terms of their progression-free survival at about 18 months to 2 years of follow-up. So this provided us with the impetus to say, well, with such an active regimen, where does transplant belong? So in the current trial, what we're looking at is the use of the RVD regimen both before stem cell mobilization with chemotherapy and after, and then a long period of maintenance until progression, versus the same treatment paradigm but with transplant administered early. So the idea is that of the two arms in the study, all patients get essentially the same treatment. The difference is where is the transplant placed, at what point in time. And the reason we think this is so important to understand is because, obviously, as I've alluded to, one size does not fit all. And very importantly, in the context of this particular randomized trial, we're not saying to one patient versus another that you get a transplant and you don't. Far from it. There is real equipoise. Patients will get transplant. It's a question of whether they get it early or late. And so we think this is a particularly important study because it helps not only provide patients with an opportunity to participate and benefit from the treatments, but gives real equipoise to patients in this context. And what we hope is that we'll provide answers to patients in the future by characterizing them, not just by their clinical features, but also by the genetics of their cancer, as to which particular myeloma most benefits from transplant and which in fact may not need it and it could reasonably be kept in reserve. Then in that case, we'll be able to advise patients in the future much more specifically as to why they might want to do a transplant early in their course or in fact keep it till later on.
Oh, okay. You mentioned then a previous study. And is that the one which I mentioned that's the 2010 ASCO abstract 8016, phase 1-2 clinical trial of IVD with and without transplant?
Yes, that's the one that actually showed the 100% response rate, Gary, and at the same time showed the high quality of response, particularly in the phase 2 population of patients on it. I will say that since that study, there have been a number of other studies led by colleagues, one led by Dr. Shaji Kumar from the Mayo Clinic, the so-called evolution trial, which showed that basically if you add more drugs to RVD conventionally, the response rates and outcomes are not necessarily better, and therefore RVD versus another combination called CyBorD were actually very active. And then most recently, my colleague Andres Jakubowiak, a dear friend and colleague from the University of Chicago, has shown very exciting data with a combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, showing very identical results, essentially. And then I think, finally, the various combinations of RVD added to other agents, including vorinostat, and also in another study, liposomal doxorubicin, have shown equally high quality responses. So what we're seeing is that this initial trial, which has subsequently led to this larger comparative study, has had the RVD regimen essentially validated both conceptually and in its constituent parts by subsequent trials. So making this whole question of where transplant belongs all the more important.
You, in that study with the 66 patients, or close to 70, what you said, it's been 3 years now since your original evaluation of that 18 months progression-free survival with 75% overall survival, close to 100. After three more years, what is the four-year progression-free survival and overall survival?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, Gary, and that long-term follow-up is ongoing. What I can share with you is that our analyses suggest that these are very sustainable aspects of clinical benefit, both in terms of PFS and overall survival. But one thing we have to be careful about here is that, obviously, whilst this was a multi-center trial, it was a single-arm experience, and patient selection may be a very important factor in how well patients do. What I can say, though, is that in the larger phase 3 experience, we're seeing very similar results to what we saw in the original phase 1, 2 in terms of a very high quality of response and durable benefit. And importantly, we're going to learn very critically from the ongoing phase 3 trial how much and how long that benefit is depending on which arm the patients are treated in. Now, I have to stress that in the current ongoing phase 3 trial, we're very impressed that the safety profile remains also quite favorable across both arms, and that's a very encouraging piece of information as well. So, I think the early trial that you alluded to continues to show encouraging results with longer follow-up, but I can't, I'm afraid, be too specific about that without, the full analysis available, which is, as I say, ongoing. But I can share with you that subsequent studies built upon it are reproducing those results as well with the same durations of benefit seen. So we do think that the regimen and the principles behind the regimen, as embodied, for example, when you combine carfilzomib with lenalidomide and dex, showing the same kind of quality of responses and durability of responses, points to the fact that this three-drug platform is probably something of a new standard of care in the upfront setting for younger patients.
One other thing along that line is you say RVD, and I know you had mentioned before in another conversation that we've had that there's a difference between RVD and VRD, and you found that...
Yes, Gary, that's a great point, and thank you for raising it, because people wonder why we use the terms differently. Well, the evolution study, which I mentioned before, led by my friend and colleague Shaji Kumar from Mayo Clinic, looked at what we call VRD. This is a regimen where dexamethasone is given basically once a week, and lenalidomide given for 2 weeks on and then 1 week off, with the bortezomib administered days 1, 4, 8, and 11, according to the classical schedule. And what I would say is that particular regimen, because of the difference in the way the dexamethasone is given and the difference in the way it's partnered, is associated with two differences compared to classical RVD. One of them is that the response rate doesn't appear to be quite as good, although we have to be very careful about that because cross-trial comparisons can be very misleading. But I think what is more important, arguably, and probably more valid, is that the rates of neuropathy are lower if you partner the dexamethasone constantly with the bortezomib, and we've shown that the rates of neuropathy with that approach are in fact substantially reduced, particularly the more severe forms of neuropathy, which of course can be such a challenge with bortezomib. And on that same note, Gary, what we're also developing now is approaches using bortezomib subcutaneously to minimize or try to minimize the neuropathy as much as we possibly can. And in the current phase 3 trial, the ability to go to subcutaneous bortezomib is feasible, and we're actually conducting trials looking at both RVD in the classical form given subcutaneously, as well as a new idea which is called RVD Lite, specifically designed for older patients, where we're trying to really minimize the side effects of the regimen but preserve the efficacy.
Good. Thank you very much, Doctor. One final question before we get into the questions from the panel, and that is that there's a number of newer drugs, Kyprolis, Pomalyst, and daratumumab, I guess, is coming up pretty quickly. But we can't call it a new drug yet, I don't think. But how, you know, how do they fit? How do these agents fit into, and combined with stem cell transplants? And in addition, the side effects that were noted of PN for the RVD combination, and would these newer combination of drugs benefit people who have issues with PN?
Well, I think it's a great question.
No,
absolutely. And I think it's a great question, Gary. And I would reemphasize the point that with the use of bortezomib up front, particularly if one can go subcutaneously and also be smart about the partnering of dexamethasone and the use of hydration and various symptomatic measures, peripheral neuropathy can be, you know, obviously very actively managed. What we found, though, is, of course, carfilzomib, which is a second-generation proteasome inhibitor. This drug, very excitingly, not only is it very potent, but it's also associated with a much, much lower rate of peripheral neuropathy. And so certainly in the relapsed and refractory setting where it's currently approved, you know, it's an ideal choice for patients in whom peripheral neuropathy is a challenge. I think one has to be careful, though, because no drug that we use these days, or ever, frankly, has ever been side effect free, and especially if they're effective in cancer care. And in that regard, it's important to note that whilst most patients tolerate carfilzomib very well, there are important other side effects that include cardiac side effects, pulmonary side effects, and sometimes both renal and also effects on blood pressure, which are important to be aware of. Fortunately, they're not common, but they're very important to be on the lookout for. The key difference, of course, though, is that carfilzomib is associated with much less PN, and in that regard, Dr. Jakubowiak's work, which I think has been, you know, really groundbreaking. Andre's work has shown not only the same high rates of response as we see with RVD, but he's also demonstrated that the rate of peripheral neuropathy is about 25% or so, which is much lower than we see classically with RVD. Having said that, as I mentioned, when we use RVD subcutaneously, we're seeing anecdotally much lower rates of peripheral neuropathy as well. So we're going to have various options for patients. Now, in terms of other new agents, pomalidomide is obviously a very exciting new IMID and may have important advantages over Revlimid or lenalidomide. Interestingly, lenalidomide is associated with a lot of muscle cramping and sometimes can be associated with a sort of magnification of peripheral neuropathy, and patients will describe this, as you know, Gary, where they feel that the two drugs together, for example, bortezomib and lenalidomide, can actually be quite challenging from the point of view of the muscle cramps and the PN. What's exciting about pomalidomide is it doesn't seem to be associated with the same degree of muscle cramping that lenalidomide is. It's extremely active. It works when lenalidomide has failed, and it also works when thalidomide has failed, and frankly, it also works when Velcade's failed and also Kyprolis. So it's a great drug for using in the relapse setting. In the context of using it up front, I think we have to be very, very careful, because at the end of the day, we need drugs that we can use in reserve when our early treatments have run out of steam, but also very importantly, certainly in the context of the U.S., the approval for pomalidomide is in the relapsed refractory setting, and I think in that regard, until we have more data, it remains obviously vital to use the drug in the correct context. Now, finally, Gary, you mentioned daratumumab, which is a very exciting new antibody. This is complementing another new antibody called elotuzumab, which is a little further in development and is currently in phase 3 trials right now, and I think shows great promise. That's elotuzumab, which targets a thing on the myeloma cell called CS1. That drug seems to be most effective when you combine it with a dance partner like either lenalidomide or bortezomib, and that's great. I mean, the responses, particularly with lenalidomide, have been very promising. What's particularly interesting about daratumumab is even at the early phase trials, which we've been fortunate to be part of with our friends and partners in Europe, specifically in Denmark and Holland, we've seen in the early phase trial with daratumumab that the drug on its own has been associated with a very promising response rate in patients with very advanced myeloma. That response rate's been about 50%. Now, with that kind of signal in advanced disease, that's very promising. And so daratumumab is now being combined with lenalidomide. That study is actually just about to open here at Dana-Farber. It's been open a little while longer in Europe, and the preliminary results are very promising. And we're also opening across the country a single-arm study with daratumumab as a phase 2 agent in which a number of centers are involved and are already open, in fact, where the drug is being given to patients with advanced myeloma who obviously are in need of it because obviously other treatments have not worked for them or failed them. And so consequently, daratumumab is being studied in that context. Now, Gary, the question is where will that end up? It'll hopefully come forward into the upfront setting as elotuzumab already has, but I think that's still very much work in process and is coming down the line. And to your question, you know, how does that belong in terms of transplant? Obviously, we'll have to see. But my point is that I think that as patients think about their choices, probably the way I would think about it is, obviously, we have lenalidomide and bortezomib in the upfront setting. We have transplant that may help the majority of younger patients, but a significant proportion may be able to keep it in reserve. And then if and when and as transplant may not work for someone and their maintenance or other strategies may run out of steam, the important thing is that they then have options like carfilzomib, like pomalidomide, and like daratumumab that they can then reach to bring their disease back under control.
Well, fantastic. Thank you, Doctor. It looks like we've got a lot of good things coming up in the future as well. What I'd like to do now is to turn it over to the panel, who has a number of questions. And Nick, are you online?
I believe so. Can you hear me?
Okay. Nick, you're up.
Excellent. So first, thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Richardson. I know we all appreciate your engagement here, and it's terrific to have you.
My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure, Nick. My pleasure.
So in full disclosure, I'm in the process of surviving not only myeloma, but also surviving total therapy treatment for myeloma. So this informs to some degree the questions I want to ask, and I'm afraid they're somewhat long. I want to qualify them first by noting that, as you say, transplants and indeed novel agents don't benefit everybody, and you know, one size does not fit all. I'm really speaking within the context of patients that have a standard risk disease that is responsive to therapy and who are young and healthy enough to withstand aggressive treatment and benefit, frankly, from having more than 5 years of life expectancy added. And there's also no question that novel agents have absolutely been game changers and are achieving, as you point out, a depth of response that used to require a transplant to achieve. So with that being said, as I was trying to think of what questions would be interesting to ask, I noticed that this very month a new report was just published, which was a Chinese retrospective study that, unlike a lot of comparisons that look at novel agents versus transplants absent those novel agents, this retrospective study compared a single transplant with novel agents against novel agents alone and found materially better progression-free survival and overall survival at the five-year point. And it was a retrospective study and not a statistically perfect analysis, but at some point, isn't there enough logic and anecdotal evidence to suggest that if novel agents alone aren't curing people and melphalan is effective, then melphalan plus novel agents would be better than just novel agents by themselves?
It's a great question, Nick, and it's the central issue, and we do have a number of lines of information that can help us answer this question. I think the first thing to share with you is that the original study that looked at whether or not transplant helped everyone was actually published by the French group led by Jean-Paul Fomond back in the late 90s, in which he showed, in contrast to some of the other studies at the time, that whilst there was no doubt that early transplant resulted in an improvement in progression-free survival compared to later transplant, it didn't impact overall survival. In other words, patients who had later transplant lived just as long overall as those who had it earlier. Now, that was in the pre-novel therapy era. More recently since then, there have been a number of retrospective studies which suggested almost the opposite of just what you've said from the Chinese. There was the publication from the Mayo group that showed no difference in overall survival using lenalidomide and dexamethasone as initial treatment followed by early transplant versus the other way around as one example. I think the most recent and valuable data addressing your question has come actually from my colleague and dear friend Antonio Palombo from Turin, who has shown in a couple now of randomized trials that the use of lenalidomide and dex followed then by either novel therapy added to melphalan at low dose versus transplant followed then by maintenance resulted in the following observations. The most interesting observation in my mind was not surprisingly the toxicities of the non-transplant arm was substantially less than the transplant arm. What was also very interesting was that the response rates between the two arms were actually the same. But what was very impressive to me was that the progression-free...
Oh, the plot was just getting thick.
I think Dr. Richardson has, we've just dropped his call. We'll just get him to call us again.
Sure.
He's not sitting there still talking away.
I know.
That would be sad.
Gary, can you please just introduce all the panelists by the time I just get Dr. Richardson
sure,
back
sure.
on?
Sure,
thank
okay.
you. Thank you, Doc.
Yeah. Well, you know, for all those who don't know, I didn't introduce the panelists prior, that Nick is a survivor. He also is a blogger, has a great blog. If you just would take his name and Google Nick's myeloma blog, you'll find some great information on the program that's at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, who has some of the best survival rates around. In addition, you know, in his spare time, he has a rock band, and he is an executive at a large corporation. So he's definitely an interesting member of our panel. We also have Pat, and Pat has a blog by the name of Myeloma. Multiple Myeloma blog, I think it is. Is that right, Pat? Do I got that right?
That's correct.
And Pat is not only a blog author, he also has a number of books on myeloma.
Dr. Richardson back with us. Yes,
okay.
I think so. Dr. Richardson, can you hear?
Yes. No, I'm so sorry, Priya. That just literally, the line just went completely dead. So I'm sorry about that, gentlemen.
No problem.
No worries, but we lost you just at the climax of your conclusion.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize, Nick. Well, what it really was just simply to bring home the point that in the randomized data from Dr. Palumbo's studies, the progression-free survival benefit was in favor of the transplant. And very importantly, and this is the most recent and important message from these studies as well, was that maintenance, which was again another randomization in those trials, maintenance until progression for both arms, whether they had transplantation or not, resulted in a significant survival benefit. So this was, I think, really a very important preliminary observation from these trials, recognizing there's a little more time for their maturity to come through, because to your point, Nick, they would support the construct that novel therapy plus transplant would appear to be outperforming novel therapy plus conventionally dosed melphalan or cyclophosphamide. The other trial looked at cyclophosphamide. The critical ingredient that is absolutely missing from the Antonio studies is a proteasome inhibitor. That was not in either of those studies, and therefore was a bit like sort of leaving the Air Force out of the Army, Navy, Air Force kind of platform when one's thinking of treatment. So that, I think, makes our trials all the more important, because essentially what they're looking at, or what we're looking at, is the three-drug combination with the proteasome inhibitor. And to your point, Nick, how we will best understand from this prospective evaluation is exactly who benefits from early transplant versus those who benefit from it later. So to your question, which is surely everybody needs a transplant, I would say the data would suggest that transplants are a very important part of the treatment of younger patients. The critical question is when and where. And the randomized trials that we're leading, not just only the RVD-IFM Dana-Farber study, which is the major U.S. effort, but also my colleagues in Europe under the European Myeloma Network are doing a very similar trial to ours, asking the same question. And what we hope is that both studies will provide information that will be critical for patients in the future, and also, for that matter, patients right now as they explore their choices. And I'm kind of very reminded of basically some comments from a wonderful patient advocate who we're so lucky to have as part of our group on the Alliance and the NCI, Dr. Jim O'Mell, who presented at an investigator meeting of ours about 10 days ago to us as a patient advocate the importance of this question, because he is a myeloma survivor too, feels that this is the critical question for younger patients at this time.
Great. I have one related question, again, of particular interest to younger patients. And I do realize there's some irony in that I should be asking this question of my doctor, Barlagi, because he's not helping this particular facet. But obviously, there are any number of trials that are being done between no transplant or single transplant, which may or may not have maintenance and the inclusion of novel agents, including the proteasome inhibitors. If nobody really believes that a single transplant cures a meaningful percentage of patients, but there are some doctors, my own prominent among them, who do believe that total therapy, including novel agents and tandem transplants with maintenance, does offer curative potential for a material number of low-risk patients and long remission for others. So the rub here is that if he really believes that he's curing people that way, he doesn't want to randomize people into a protocol he doesn't believe in. Do you know of any efforts to compare at any centers or across centers a tandem transplantation with novel agents and maintenance versus novel agents and maintenance alone?
Absolutely. The current CTN trial, the 0702 trial, which has continued to enroll very robustly and is actually now just coming to a conclusion of its enrollment, hopefully in the middle of November, is answering just this question. And whilst I have, Nick, the highest regard for Bart and for his efforts in really pushing the envelope with intensive treatments and so forth, I do want to emphasize that without prospective randomized trials, recognizing that the key point about randomization is that patients retain as much control and equipoise in the process as possible, i.e. they're not straitjacketed into any treatment, that there are treatment options, and that obviously if, for example, a patient assigned to transplant, it's becoming clear is not safe to do, can opt out of that option. And conversely, a patient who is assigned to non-transplant initial treatment, it becomes clear that transplant will help them, then they have the ability to move to that transplant. And I would stress that in our trial, for example, that ability is absolutely implicit. So this is not a sort of all or nothing situation, a terribly important point for patients, because control and equipoise for them is vital. So putting that into the context of what we're talking about is I think tremendously important. So on that note, the randomized trial that the CTN are doing right now, and as I say, almost fully accrued, is looking at one transplant followed by RVD consolidation followed by Revlimid maintenance. The other arm is basically two transplants followed by Revlimid maintenance, and the third arm is a single transplant followed by Revlimid maintenance, which is the sort of current standard, if you will, for standard patients, or not for standard, but for patients, generally speaking, who undergo transplants. So, you know, that particular CTN effort, I think, will be very important. And you may say, well, why are we doing second transplants at all? Because at the end of the day, for example, in French studies, they showed that the second transplants really weren't adding anything. Well, we have to say that, you know, again, it's important not to look at one trial as answering the whole question. You have to look at multiple trials overall to get the answer. And in that regard, the recent experience from the Dutch-German group suggested that in a subset of patients, two transplants may actually convey benefit, although it wasn't necessarily definitive because the way this trial was set up, the two transplant piece was only done in Germany and not in Holland, so it was a little more difficult to dissect that out. My point is, Nick, that two transplants remains an important question, and we hope the CTN trial, which has just been completed, will guide us in that regard. The good thing about the current study that we're running is that we collect enough stem cells for at least two transplants, and that allows us then to offer patients who do, for example, have an early transplant, if a second transplant at some point later in their course is needed, it may be available to them as well. So again, we try to retain that flexibility, recognizing, as you point out so eloquently, you know, there are centers such as Barts where total therapy appears to them anyway to be the only way forward. I would stress, and I think you know this, Nick, Barts pulling back a bit from that, and he has various strategies that he calls total therapy light, for example, for patients whom he considers they do not need as much intensive treatment, which in a sense actually resonates exactly with what we're proposing to better understand with our current studies.
Certainly. Thank you very much, and that's extremely interesting and helpful, both generally and personally. One very quick follow-up. The French and Dutch studies that you mentioned, when we talk about a second transplant, were they tandems relatively one after the other, or are they spaced apart?
Right.
The French
studies looked at single versus tandem, and with longer follow-up became very clear that the benefit enjoyed from tandem was modest, if at all. And then basically in that same context, the Dutch group did not, in their experience, go straight to tandem because they found that these two back-to-back would be too toxic from the standpoint of being able to optimally tolerate treatments afterwards. And so for that reason, in the so-called Hovum study, the Dutch side of the trial did not get two transplants back-to-back. The Germans, however, chose to still explore that option, and in that context showed benefit for those patients who were able to tolerate the two. But again, when you look at these populations of patients, one has to be very careful because, again, the question of whether tandem is better than single is a burning one, but it's a burning one because the issue is what do novel therapies do? And the general consensus is that novel therapies may actually allow us to be quite effective with just a single transplant. And the real danger, Nick, is that if you do two transplants and they don't go well for you, you may compromise your ability to then get more novel therapy, be it blood counts, be it other end organ function aspects that are so important. So that's why we're a little cautious about the tandem. But I have to say the CTN trial, I think, has been a great success in terms of enrollment and indeed also participation. And this second transplant question, I think, will be answered, hopefully, by that study.
Great. Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Nick. Absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Nick. Jack, you online?
I am online. Dr. Richardson, it's always a pleasure to listen to you, and I'm sure you're among many people, including your colleague, Dr. Anderson, who are very happy in Boston these days.
Well, you know, Jack, you're very kind for saying that. Obviously, as you can judge from my accent, baseball is not my sport. But I have to say, I love Boston and I love the Red Sox. They're a great bunch, and I'm very glad to see them doing so well. But what I love, Pat, is it's sorry, Jack, I apologize. What I love, Jack, it's called the World Series. And I find that it always makes me smile because for those on the call from India, for example, cricket is much more of a global sport.
That's true.
Anyway, but nonetheless, you're quite right. It's good days in Boston.
My first question goes back to the comments you made about maintenance.
Mm.
Several maintenance trials have been done. They've all shown that it's effective from a standpoint of progression-free survival, maybe showing a two-year or so improvement. But I haven't heard that kind of comment with respect to overall survival. Maybe there's a little improvement. Maybe there's not. Maybe the trials haven't been going on long enough. Can you say more about the overall survival? Can you actually quantify it?
Yes.
Like they have done with progression-free?
Yeah, yes, Jack. I think that it's very important to start to frame that discussion because, just so you know, the Alliance or CLGB trial led by my dear friend and colleague Phil McCarthy, which was published in the New England Journal last year, in that study, patients who underwent initial treatment with novel therapy and then went on to transplant times one, to Nick's point, followed then by maintenance with lenalidomide until progression, enjoyed a substantial progression-free survival. They doubled it compared to the group who received placebo. And to the extent then that the Data Management and Safety Board assigned to the trial then suggested it be, you know, unblinded, and those patients on placebo received lenalidomide, and it's an enormous credit to those patients that participated that they were willing to do that. This study provided enormous information in my view. It showed not only the progression-free survival benefit in favor of the maintenance, but most importantly showed a survival benefit. Now, the magnitude of that benefit on the Alliance study or the CLGB trial does appear to be growing. Having said that, there are other studies in which that magnitude has been less apparent, and one of them is the French study. And the French study, led by my colleague Dr. Michel Attal, had a defined exposure to lenalidomide in both arms, the lenalidomide group actually received treatment for just about 2 years, not until progression, and both arms received lenalidomide as consolidation. Now, that study shows a substantial progression-free survival benefit in favor of lenalidomide maintenance for up to 2 years, but it has not yet shown a survival benefit, and I would argue it may not because, of course, it finished treatment after approximately 2 years. And what we know from Dr. Palumbo's studies that I just alluded to is that if you continue lenalidomide maintenance until progression in his trials, you saw survival benefit in both the transplant arm and the non-transplant arm. So in his major randomized trial, which is the one that has the most mature data, he shows survival benefit. And in our own CLGB trial, we show survival benefit. Now,
in that trial, I was just going to ask, in that CLGB trial, what was the quantity? So how do you, the number of overall survival benefit?
Yes.
Yes,
we can. I think one just have to be a little bit careful, though, because, again, it's a question of what's been presented and what's most up-to-date. But in the original New England Journal paper from 2012, a survival benefit was apparent, but obviously it wasn't of the order of magnitude of the study in terms of progression-free survival. And then most recently, in an update that Dr. McCarthy presented at the International Myeloma Workshop in Kyoto, again, a significant survival benefit was seen. But we have to be careful how we interpret these actual numbers, because what really matters is that there are median survival benefits that we see and average values, basically, to help listeners. And as I mentioned, the progression-free survival for lenalidomide maintenance was about 4 years on average versus about 2 for the control patients. And the survival benefit, the difference was significant, but it was not as big as that because obviously patients in whom the disease came back sooner and were on the control group obviously went on to receive treatment appropriately as they should do, and therefore this difference in survival is not as big. But I think it's important not to sort of misunderstand what that means. And I think the way to look at it, Jack, is as follows. We understand that this disease is not only different between patients. As we said at the beginning of the call, one size does not fit all. Far from it, myeloma is arguably one of the most heterogeneous hematologic cancers that we have. But what's really important to also understand, Jack, is that within a patient, the disease changes over time. And one of the most important scientific observations that's been increasingly validated by some very elegant work in the scientific setting, which a number of colleagues, including, of course, my chief inventor, Dr. Anderson, have been very involved, is being the construct of what we call clonal heterogeneity, or the way the disease changes within a patient's own bone marrow and so on. And that means, therefore, it's very, very important to think in terms of maintenance therapy as a means of controlling these clones and keeping them under some kind of control for as long as possible. And Jack, if I may, I'd bring your attention to a piece of work presented at ASCO by my colleague Antonio Palumbo, who looked at maintenance therapy with both bortezomib and thalidomide in older patients who did not undergo transplant and showed a survival benefit to that approach compared to patients who did not receive maintenance. So this is yet another trial showing survival benefit, recognizing that it's not in the transplant setting, but it's for older patients. And what he showed that was so fascinating was that in the maintenance patients, when the disease came back, the time to next treatment the time required to next treatment was on average about a year, which was remarkable because it was far shorter in those patients who relapsed on no maintenance. And it supports the construct that some duration of maintenance conveys biological control to each individual patient's disease, such that when the disease does try to come back, there is some degree of biological difference compared to those patients who are not maintained. And so whilst obviously I'm, you know, speaking generally, because these are trial results overall, the arguments for maintenance do seem to be increasingly supported by the various trials that we have. So whilst, you know, the survival benefit in the transplant trials remains actuarially relatively modest, I think the aggregate information and the implications from the science suggest that the clinical benefit in the long term and the importance of maintenance will I believe, continue to be a very important part of what we do in myeloma therapy.
Thank you very much. My second question has to do with the fact that ASH is only about 5 or 6 weeks away, and if you were to put on your crystal ball without providing any spoiler alerts, I wonder what we as patients, maybe one or two things we should be looking for MASH.
Well, I think, again, we've been so spoiled, haven't we, Jack, with the various ASH meetings. There have always been a sort of feast
Indeed.
Of new data. And I think that what you'll hear at this year's ASH in New Orleans is, again, important updates for existing trials, important updates for initial treatment for older patients who are not transplant candidates, but will, you know, potentially be candidates to receive novel therapy versus, well, not even conventional treatment anymore, but sort of older novel therapy such as melphalan, prednisone, and thalidomide. And I think very, very importantly, we're going to hear more about some of the newer agents that are starting to be good dance partners with drugs like bortezomib and lenalidomide. There's also going to be a lot of nice data on the combinations such as carfilzomib and pomalidomide, which are very promising. So I think you'll see a lot of information on the antibodies, on new small molecules, particularly one that I think is intriguing are the histone deacetylase inhibitors, which really do seem to not only make proteasome inhibitors work better, but very importantly seem to synergize with immunomodulators. And then I think we're going to see a lot of exciting further data on the monoclonal antibody story, daratumumab, elotuzumab, and so on. And then finally, we're going to get upfront information, you know, on for older patients that I think will be very, very important for myeloma patients to hear about.
Thank you very much.
Pat, are you online?
I am here, and thank you, Doctor. I was going to ask about maybe the question shouldn't be if to transplant, but when, but you've touched on that a little bit. I guess my question is, are researchers working on ways to make transplants better? Maybe instead of trying to make them obsolete, they can be improved enough that they become indispensable.
Well, Pat, it's a very great question you ask, because that is a one thing we haven't really touched on. You know, is transplant, you know, in itself, you know, a walk in the park? Well, it, as for all of us who care for patients who go through it, and for those of you who've been through it, it's not a walk in the park. It's a very difficult process, and it can be very challenging. I have to say it's become infinitely safer, and I think that's enormous credit to the advances in supportive care and, you know, at the centers that do stem cell transplantation. I'm very impressed that the absolute linchpin of successful transplantation is the quality of nursing care. And I think that in the context of improvements in the management of transplant-related complications, we've seen the modality become substantially safer and a lot more tolerable. I think that there are new forms of melphalan that we're studying, which I think hold great promise, but they're very, very early, where we can try and minimize stem cell damage. Because one thing I didn't touch on, and I really should, because it's an important question of when to transplant early versus late, is the fact that we do worry that there is substantial genotoxic damage from chemotherapy, from traditional chemotherapy. And melphalan, unfortunately, is probably one of the most genotoxic drugs we use. And the problem for that is that in the long term, as patients live longer with their illness and, God willing, enjoy much longer and deeper remissions, the real danger becomes that they can then, of course, face the challenge of what we call secondary cancers, which are things like myelodysplasia and leukemia. We typically see these from melphalan. We see them also from other chemotherapies like DCEP and other combinations as well. And in the trials that we were just talking about, it was clearly shown in the French study that this incidence of second primaries that they saw was influenced by prior genotoxic chemotherapy. In the case of the French study, both melphalan and DCEP. So these are important considerations going forward, and why they're important, of course, is because whilst fortunately they're uncommon, with an incidence probably of around 7 or 8% or so, or something of that order, they obviously are very important for those patients who are affected by them. And what we've realized is that there is a possible interaction with lenalidomide as well, that's important to bear in mind. The good news is that it is uncommon. The other piece of good news from the trials is that once patients are out about 2 years or so, the incidence of these secondary issues falls off and becomes much less. So it sort of supports the construct of lenalidomide maintenance being continuous, because at the end of the day, if you only do it for a couple of years, you may actually buy the risk of second cancer without the potential benefit, which is an important point. So, Pat, to your point, we're looking to improve transplant in a number of ways. One, we're trying to improve supportive care. Two, we're trying to improve the quality of induction treatment so that the side effects that some patients encounter that are residual from their induction treatment are minimized during transplant. And three, a very important construct, which I think needs to be emphasized to listeners, is the emerging role of consolidation. In other words, after transplant, you can actually use novel therapies in combination to consolidate the potential benefit that they have gotten from the transplant itself. And this drives back to a question that Nick raised, which is, what is the role of the second transplant? And it may be that you don't need a second transplant if you have effective consolidation. And consolidation, interestingly, can be remarkably well tolerated because you've rebooted the patient's immune system and rebooted their marrow with their stem cells. And so what we've been struck by is that the use of consolidation after transplant can be surprisingly well tolerated by most patients in ways that we wouldn't necessarily have expected. So there are a number of ways of doing this. Now, in terms of the actual platform for conditioning, the use of melphalan, is there evidence that adding to melphalan in conditioning can improve outcome of transplant? Well, so far, I'm afraid, Pat, the evidence of adding stuff to melphalan has been quite limited. Strategies adding bortezomib to melphalan have suggested that that can help improve the quality of responses. But interestingly enough, if patients receive bortezomib as part of induction and as part of consolidation, the actual contribution of bortezomib during transplant when added to melphalan itself may actually be quite modest, recognizing that the trials that support that observation are relatively limited in size and scope, so we have to be careful. Are there other drugs that we can add to melphalan? Well, there are some innovative ideas looking at this, ranging from, you know, the strategies of trying to add a proteasome inhibitor to potentially looking at ways we might add an antibody or something of that sort. I think those are very early. It's important to remind listeners that in the old days we used to combine melphalan with TBI, total body irradiation, and whilst that certainly was very active and very powerful, the reason it was abandoned is because most centers recognized that the combination was more toxic than melphalan alone, and randomized trials again suggested excess toxicity for melphalan and TBI without necessarily much benefit. So, Pat, one of the challenges in transplant is how to maintain the intensity of conditioning and to do so safely. And right now, most of the direction is, can we use consolidation as a strategy to improve transplant and then use maintenance to build on that platform to truly drive deeper and longer lasting responses? So I think, in short, the way transplant's being improved is by what we put around it, be it induction, consolidation, and maintenance.
Thank you, Doctor. That's wonderful.
And thank you, Pat. Doctor, at this point, we take... But we're running a little late. I don't know if you have a few extra minutes in your schedule or not.
Oh, absolutely. I have as much time as you want.
Oh, that is fantastic. Priya, we have any callers dialing in right now? I know we've got 17 questions, so I know there's got to be a number of people ready to ask Dr. Richardson their questions. Anything, Priya, or should I go to some of the questions? Well, let me do that. Let me go to some of the questions that we have here. I have one. We talk about transplants, but Liz would like to know, how is the decision to do a donor transplant made? Why are donor transplants more risky for myeloma patients than other cancers? Are strides being made to achieve better survival statistics?
Well, Liz is, I mean, these questions are great, Gary, because they sort of fill out bits of the discussion that we've not had time to cover. So I'm very grateful to Liz because this question is perfect. Allotransplant, of course, in other blood cancers has been curative. Leukemias, both of the acute and chronic variety, can be cured with allogeneic transplant, where essentially the immune system of the patient is replaced by a donor immune system. And typically, this requires diseases that are wholly accessible within the marrow compartment, such as acute leukemia, and do not have what myeloma, of course, possesses in spades, which is this ability to hide itself in bone cortex, and also, of course, resist the immune system by producing its own highly immunosuppressive local and humoral and also systemic factors. So myeloma, I'm afraid, is uniquely able to shield itself from attacks from the immune system in the context of allogeneic transplant. And so what we've seen is that whilst there have been this tantalizing signal from allotransplant that a subset of patients benefit in the long term, a proportion, unfortunately, progress. And in that context, or the majority do, hello, I'm sorry. Can you hear me, Gary?
Yes.
Oh, definitely. Good. I'm sorry, just because the line was wobbling a bit there. And the other unfortunate thing about allotransplant is that graft versus host disease, which represents the immune system of the donor, unfortunately attacking the patient, graft versus host disease can be a real challenge. So where are we going with allotransplant? Well, I think that where we're going is how can we enhance the efficacy of allotransplant in the way that autologous transplant's been enhanced by novel therapies, and I think therein lies the future. Allotransplant itself is being made much safer. We've got much better drugs for combating graft versus host disease. We've got much better drugs, excitingly actually, for combating a major allocomplication in myeloma of the old days, which was this terrible damage to the liver called veno-occlusive disease. And there have been these exciting new developments, new agents in that area. Those drugs also have effects that are favorable on graft versus host disease to boot, so that's actually pretty exciting. And in the same context, the addition of novel therapies to the platform, I think will hopefully allow allotransplant to become something that we would be able to use, obviously recognizing it's for younger patients, ideally with perfect matches from siblings, which is the best source, and at the same time the ability then to combine approaches that include vaccines, that include ways to augment the immune system and get around the shields that myeloma throws up. Those are the sorts of things that I think will drive what Liz is obviously driving at, which is how can we use allogeneic transplant to cure. So some of the myeloma world thinks that allogeneic transplant is no longer viable. And when I say the myeloma world, I mean my colleagues, my partners in research. I'm not sure it's as dire as that. I think allotransplant does have a role, but I think we need to really think carefully about how we go forward. And our own center's policy towards allotransplant is that it should only be done in the context of a clinical trial, because we need obviously to make sure that we learn as much as we possibly can and also quality assure the safety of the patient in the context of the procedure.
Thank you. That's excellent. Karen asks, what is the latest, most, and everybody would like to know this question, I think. What is the latest, most promising treatment for multiple myeloma that comes closest to a cure?
Well, I think that's an incredibly good question. It's a very difficult one to answer in one swoop, because I think what we have to recognize is that myeloma within a patient isn't one cell, it isn't one line of cells. It's a whole sort of basket full of cells that may share a particular characteristic. They may all be IgA-producing kappa light chain-restricted CD138-positive cells, but at the end of the day, they're actually multiple different clones. And that being the case, you can see the logic for saying that it's going to be very difficult for one drug to be the game changer in the classic sense and generate the true cure. In fact, I would argue it's biologically impossible. I think what we'll see is what we're actually marching towards, which is cocktails of combinations and certain platforms driving us closer and closer to the minimal residual disease state that generates what I consider what I call a functional cure. And those kinds of combinations will include proteasome inhibitors, they'll include immunomodulators, I believe they'll include drugs like histone deacetylase inhibitors, I think they'll include, very importantly, monoclonal antibodies, and then they'll include other small molecules as well as, ideally, improved chemotherapeutics, in other words, chemotherapies that are better and less toxic than our traditional cytotoxics, all put together in rational fashions that will drive us towards functional cure. And if I wanted to sort of go to the question, as I think central point is, what do we have in 2013 that's really exciting and brand new? I would say probably the breakthrough drug of the last 12 months or so is arguably in the monoclonal antibody class, and that's daratumumab, recognizing that ELO is also a very attractive agent. But I think if one wants to look to a sort of new class of drug that's going to overdrive classical mechanisms of resistance, for example, I think daratumumab has to stand as one very promising example.
Fantastic. Murphy.
Gary, I would like to mention that listeners who have a question for Dr. Richardson can please press
Great.
1 on your keypads. Yeah, and we can bring them. We can bring you live to ask your question. You can press 1 on your keypad if you have a question for Dr. Richardson. We have a question online. Yes, the caller from 301229, please ask your question.
Yes, my name is Stu. A 70-year-old man, and I've just completed a transplant procedure. The transplant was done on 9/11, as it would be. And looking forward, at least at the 100-day mark, I'm going to have to make a decision in terms of maintenance. And I was wondering what your views would be. And I know you've talked about consolidation after transplant, and I'm not quite sure what that terminology means.
Well, so nice of you to call in, and thank you for doing so, you know, so shortly after your transplant. You sound great, by the way, so delighted. I hope things are going well. Consolidation simply means that as opposed to just doing a maintenance approach, such as just, say, lenalidomide alone, that other drugs are added to it. So there are various cocktails or platforms that are used. The most commonly used currently is a combination of lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, typically given in the form of 3 weekly cycles for 2 or 3 or sometimes up to 4 cycles, starting at around day 100 or just before. And then once those are completed, then maintenance follows. And maintenance typically consists of lenalidomide alone. It can be given either continuously or 3 weeks on and 1 week off. And it starts usually at a low dose, usually at about 10 milligrams for the first 3 months, and then if drug is well tolerated and there aren't unacceptable side effects, you can safely increase to 15 milligrams 3 weeks on and 1 week off thereafter. Now, a number of us have looked at the idea of what we call augmented maintenance, and what that means is maintenance is a little bit more than just lenalidomide alone, and investigators such as my friend and colleague Sagar Lonial at Emory have developed the idea of integrating lenalidomide and bortezomib together, for example, as a maintenance strategy. What Sagar's shown very nicely in that patients with higher risk features, lenalidomide given 3 weeks on and 1 week off, with bortezomib, for example, given every 2 weeks, is one very attractive maintenance approach. Just so you know, we're not in the kind of data-free zone. This has been studied prospectively in trials using a different proteasome inhibitor and IMiD platform, namely bortezomib and thalidomide. And I alluded to that earlier in the non-transplant setting in Dr. Palumbo's study, where that combination was shown to be highly effective. So my suggestion would be to sit down with your team and ask them, you know, what would they recommend or what would they consider for consolidation for you as one option. And in terms of maintenance, our own center's approach is based upon the strength of the Alliance and CLGB data, based upon the new data from Dr. Palumbo's group showing survival benefit to maintenance. We do recommend maintenance to patients outside of the context of clinical trials and in the context of clinical trials. So we usually recommend rate maintenance unless there's a contraindication such as allergy or other unacceptable risks that may pose themselves. And then if, for example, say someone has an allergy to lenalidomide and can't tolerate it, we might say, why don't we think about a different agent for maintenance such as bortezomib and administer that every 2 weeks as one example.
Well, thank you very much. Just one follow-on question. Is there any thinking of not having any medications after the transplant?
Well, there is, and you know, for example, some folks like to just use bisphosphonate alone, for example, as a way of keeping bone disease to a minimum after transplant. We like to use bisphosphonate, but we like to do more than that. Now, there are some groups who don't believe in maintenance and feel that it doesn't add anything. And I understand their position and obviously respect their view, but I personally think the aggregate data suggest otherwise, and I think it becomes a personal choice. I don't think you're making a mistake or doing something wrong if you do not want to choose maintenance, and that would be the wrong message. But I would say the information overall suggests there is benefit to maintenance, weighing the risks and benefits overall and sitting down with your doc and discussing those pros and cons. On average, usually, maintenance is generally well tolerated in my experience, particularly lenalidomide as a single agent, and if you can adjust the dose to tolerance as well. Important sort of point to make is that lenalidomide, when it's given up front at 25 milligrams, is having an anti-cancer effect in a very direct sense. When we give it as a lower dose, 10 to 15 post-transplant, it's more of what we call an immunomodulator. It's designed to stimulate your immune system and get it into the sort of right space that it needs to be with the new stem cell population on board to fight your disease immunologically. So important point to remember. And obviously when you take lenalidomide, beware of clots, blood clots. That's always a worry. So make sure you're on aspirin. And finally, one thing we do encounter, which I really want to share because it's something that's underappreciated, sometimes with lenalidomide you can run into chronic issues with irritable bowel. It's almost like a diarrhea that can be a problem. I affectionately call it revy belly, but the fact of the matter is that it's a bloody nuisance, or can be. And in that context...
that ever go away?
Well, you can reduce doses, and frankly, what you can do is use Imodium as an antidiarrheal. But one of the little vignettes that's a little, you know, I think a wonderful thing to try is Cholestipol. What we realize is that the diarrheas that follow transplant are actually in part possibly immune-mediated. And what you can do is you take a little Cholestipol, which we use for patients, for example, who have bad diarrhea from chronic graft versus host disease in the allo setting. If you use a little Cholestipol, it binds bile acid, and it takes away that irritant effect to the lining of the bowel that we think may exacerbate Revlimid-related diarrhea. And in about 60 to 70% of patients who have lenalidomide-related diarrhea, we find Cholestipol successful. The good news for listeners is not everybody gets this diarrhea, far from it, but for those patients who do get revy belly, Cholestipol is well worth trying, and please discuss it with your docs. It's very simple. It's a 2-gram tablet, or it was 1-gram tablet, two, taken with meals before, and it just reduces the secretion of bile acid, and it, in my experience, has been very effective in cutting down the diarrhea. The other thing to mention is beware of food intolerance. When you take lenalidomide after transplant, your bowel may have become a little lactose intolerant, and beware also of gluten. I've had some of my patients become gluten intolerant, and when they've gone onto a gluten-free diet, the diarrhea has completely disappeared.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson. We have time just for one last question. Person calling in from 801-763, please ask your question. Just have 1 minute.
Hi, this is actually Lizzie, and I'm calling from a different number. I'm a myeloma survivor. I am 45. I was diagnosed almost 2 years ago, and I did do a tandem stem cell transplant, and I'm currently in remission. I have a quick question about how many transplants over the course of a disease can one expect to make? I know that everyone is different, but how many stem cell transplants have you seen patients been able to endure in the course of trying to fight this disease?
Well, Lizzie, it's lovely to hear your voice, and I'm glad to hear you're doing so well. I think as a younger person, a very young person, I would say, if I may, being a few years older than you are, just not too much, but several years older, but as a very young person, I think that the ability to withstand more than one or two transplants becomes, you know, very real. I mean, I think if you have the ability to tolerate more than two, that's great. I have to say the question really is how much benefit will you derive from them? So if you had two initially and clearly have done very well, that's great news. I think there's certainly scope probably for further stem cell-supported therapy at later date times in your treatment course. My own experience has been that on average, most people who are transplant eligible have at least one. Some have two. Very few have three or four. Very few. One of my patients who I love dearly has had two autos. He then had an allo, which unfortunately failed him. It did not work. But he was salvaged by novel therapies and did really, really well for many years. But then, unfortunately, he developed a therapy-related leukemia. And we successfully did another allo using an unrelated donor, and he continues to do very well. But he's now, you know, we're at 20 years, so he's done extraordinarily well. But you can see that's a rather unique situation. So my answer, I guess, Lizzie, would be it kind of depends on how you do. But my advice to you would be, as a young and otherwise fit person, the ability to have further stem cell therapy is very real. But please be very careful because at the end of the day, your body can withstand only so much, and what you want to make sure is that you don't push it across a certain limit. Having said that, I think we've gotten much smarter how we use our treatments, and really excitingly, Lizzie, we have really good drugs, as I mentioned, for some of the more serious toxicities of transplant, ranging from graft versus host disease to liver complications to others, and these drugs are really making a difference. So, you know, I think that. You know, I don't want to say you can't have them anymore. That would be wrong. I would just say be careful how you approach it, recognizing how well you've done so far.
Hmm. Very good. Thank you. Gives a lot of hope.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Richardson. we have gone over our time limit. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was wonderful having you here, and it was a great discussion. Gary, Pat, Jack, and Nick, thank you so much for all that you do. Thank you all listeners, for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us on the 29th of October to talk about myeloma survival rate, life expectancy with Dr. Hoffmeister, Pat, Gary, and Cynthia at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. For more details of upcoming shows, please visit trilex.com/curetalk or mail me, priya@trilex.com. To search for myeloma trials, please use MMRF's trial search tool at myeloma.trilex.com/ask. The link for today's show will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much to Nick and Gary and Pat and Jack. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Richards. It was fantastic.
Well, no, truly my pleasure, and your questions were, you know, spot on. Really appreciate them.
Sorry for the technical difficulties.
You know, Gary, please don't worry. I'm just so impressed. I mean, obviously, Priya is calling from India, and I've got to say, you guys came over loud and clear. I wasn't quite sure where I lost the call, why. It just simply went dead, but I suspect that's a satellite thing. I'm almost certain that's what that was.
Well,
thank you so
obviously,
much, Doctor.
Yes, Doctor, you've did a wonderful job, and I'm just so happy that the myeloma patient community has an opportunity to hear your ideas on multiple myeloma and how, in my opinion, you save life every day.
Well, you know, it's a privilege, frankly, Gary. And one thing I wanted to say, take care of your tooth, my friend. I'm sure you know the drill. But oral infections are not to be taken lightly. So please take care of yourself in that context. And it goes without saying, but Gary, you know, Nick, Pat, and Jack, you know, anytime you need any help or advice or guidance, I'd be delighted to see you chat, whatever you need.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
No, it's absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Priya, thanks a bunch, and thank you for being such a good person on the email. That was fun. reassuring, you were my lifeline out there. So great, guys. Well, I'm actually going to the hospital now. I've got some folks to see, so I'm going to go over and do my inpatient rounds. But thanks very much, everyone. Okay, all right.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone. God bless. Bye bye.